like to call this meeting of the House Transportation Committee to order. It is currently 1:05 p.m. on Tuesday, March 24th, in room 124. Members present are Representative Nelson, Representative McCabe, Representative Mina, Representative St. Clair, and myself, Co-Chair Carrick. We should be joined very shortly by Co-Chair Eichheit as well. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business, and please take this time to silence your cell phones. Before we begin, I'd like to thank Jordan Nicholson from House Records, as well as Susan Quigley from the Juneau LIO for staffing our committee today. And as always, thank you to our co-committee aides, Meredith Trainer and Griffin Sukeo. On today's agenda, we have a presentation from the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities given by Rashad Joseph. And we do anticipate a hard stop on this presentation at 2 p.m. And today we'll be hearing about the Civil Rights Office within the department. So kind of a new, interesting topic for this committee. And later this afternoon, we have an introduction from Representative Holland and his staff, Aiden Nickel, on HB 317, Wildland-Urban Interface Maintenance Plans. And finally, we will return today to House Bill 217, Autonomous Vehicles, for further discussion and adoption of a committee substitute. So at this time, I'd like to welcome Mr. Rashad Joseph to our Department of Transportation Committee. And if you could put yourself on the record and feel free to begin your presentation. And if you want to just stop after each slide very briefly, we'll just see if there's questions as we go along. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Rashad Joseph, and I'll be giving the presentation for the DOT Civil Rights Office. So just a quick overview of our office. Our office is based in Anchorage. We are a statewide office. Currently, we have 9 employees. When we are fully staffed, there's 15 employees throughout the team. Multiple different employees have different specialties. I've been with the department for 10 years now. I've worked my way up to the position I'm in now. So as you can see in the slide, essentially what our office is here for is we're the go-between between the community as well as our federal partners when it comes to engaging with the public. We work with our communications section as well. As you can see here in the slide, essentially what the vision is for our office is to ensure transportation services are provided in a non-discriminatory manner. And so typically what we get, people don't know that the DOT has a civil rights office. And so, like I said, as you'll see in the slide, within the staff, we do a lot of different things, whether it's our small business development group. We have specialists who work on our ADA compliance throughout the agency, and then we have some other certification agents who I'll talk about as we get through the slide.
And actually, Mr. Joseph, if we could stop here, mm-hmm. I just have a quick question. What was the initial mechanism that established the Civil Rights Office within DOT, and is this something that all states have?
Yeah.
Okay.
Carrick, sorry.
Sorry, I'll move it over. Help you out.
Okay. Yeah. So, Civil Rights Act of 1964 is what establishes, and then so within the transportation, I'd say environment, because there's a lot of engagement with all communities, the majority of DOTs do have civil rights offices as well.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Thank you. Please continue.
So first up, I'm going to explain our DBE program, which is the Disadvantaged Business Enterprise Program. It's a federal program, probably one of our leading programs. It's designed to help women and minorities gain work within state agencies. And so we are the only DBE office in Alaska. We operate with a 2-person crew. They certify the DBEs. They provide training, just a litany of things to help a small business start and then to continue on with their work. And so, like I said, the criteria, as you see here, has to be 51% ownership of the person who's going through the process to be certified as a DBE. To be certified as a DBE is a very lengthy process, and we review tax records. We review quite a bit of stuff in order for a business to be certified.
We have a couple questions here. Representative McCabe and then St. Clair.
Thanks, Chair Carrick. So, Mr. Joseph, is performance one of those criteria? I mean, in other words, a disadvantaged business still has to be able to do it right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I used to fly out of the new Denver airport, not the old Stapleton, and they did a lot of this kind of thing. And when they first opened, I happened to be there when they first opened, and they had different disadvantaged businesses working, and they had cement from one business here and cement from another business here, and there was no real established criteria for those business for performance to do the right thing, to do the right job. So please tell me that's one of the criteria that's looked at for these.
Yes. So we do go through the process to ensure that the business actually knows how to do the job that he or she is saying that they can do. So a part of the packet that they have to fill out, they have to show that they're ready, willing, and able to do the actual job. And then so once they become certified, we also then provide additional training. We also will pay 50% of additional trainings that those businesses do.
Follow up. Thanks. So I'm struggling with this a little bit. So if you have a like contractors, say there's a contractor that has 10 employees and there's a disadvantaged business contractor that has 10 employees. This guy's not disadvantaged. These folks are a DBE, right? This guy's been doing it for 50 years in his business, knows how to do it, has all the training, has all the equipment, everything he needs to do. And this one is fairly young, 5-10 years. You're going to pick this one and give them the extra training to bring them up to this guy's up to the same level. Is that what I'm hearing?
We would invite both to the trainings that we host, so it wouldn't be just specific for DBEA. It's a broad training, so we'll have, you know, for instance, Granite, QAP, a bunch of them typically will come to our trainings as well too.
Thanks.
All right, Representative St. Clair says no.
I don't want to get too far in the weeds, Madam Chair.
Okay.
We're already there.
We have a very nice, beautiful, by the way, slide deck today, so maybe it'll get answered later.
A big, beautiful slide deck? Is that
a
what
big,
I just
A big, beautiful slide deck. Yes, indeed. Please continue. Okay.
So this is just more about the program. So we typically will have a goal set on our projects. We currently do not, just with the new administration, the new changes on the federal side. And so what those contract goals help us to do is to achieve the usage of the small DBEs on our projects. So like I said, for the contracting opportunities, a part of why a lot of these organizations become certified is one, so they get the designation of a DBE, but also it aids them in understanding or knowing, one, the DOT has opportunities and that they can actually come in and have a fair chance to actually get in the work. And like I said, with the support and resources, we do quite a bit of training. We partner with a lot of different organizations who then will do a dual training with our office as well.
I think we're good to continue.
Like I said before, just continued on with the compliance and oversight. The DBE program for us it's a major role, but as a whole for our agency, we are essentially reporting yearly on the amount the dollar amounts that are also used on the DBEs or how much that they actually get. And so when we report this to the feds, they will typically come back and say, okay, you either raise the goal or lower the goal, and here's why. And so like on the last item there, which is overall the DBE program, plays a crucial role in promoting equity and diversity in the transportation industry. It really and truly does. We've seen numerous DBEs who've been certified, who've gotten work all over the state.
Oh, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'll just kind of tell you my thought process and then get to the question. On the classification of what classifies as a DBE, you know, we all hear stories about dudes that are running businesses and then they make their wife 51% and she's the bookkeeper, but he's doing everything. And now, that's not to disparage businesses owned by women. Like when I was a pipe welder, there were women that were certified pipe welders and they passed the same test. But how do you weed out guys that are basically taking advantage of this? That's not this program's purpose. Mm-hmm. Like how are you able to, if you can, determine if that is happening?
So great quick question. So a part of the certification process is we do what is called an on-site review. So for your example particularly, if what we have to do, and we have to actually show it to the feds when we do our reporting, is we actually go do an on-site review. And so if it's a company, using your example, if they were operating a machine, we would actually go out, and if the woman is the 51% owner, she would need to show our certification agents, I'm operating all the equipment. I'm not just doing like the back end as well too.
And we have another question, Representative McCabe.
Thanks. Yeah. So with President Trump's new sort of pushback against DEI, essentially, are we putting any of our federal funding at risk with this particular framing, even on this slide talking about equity and diversity and in the DBE program? Mm.
Great question. So it's one we get all the time, actually. So our programs are separate from DEI, so that's a total different umbrella than anything that we do. So you have the DEI movement, if you will, and then you have the civil rights. It's two completely different things.
Okay. Thanks. Here I thought it was unique. Gets it all the time. I feel so bad.
Please continue.
And it's just some historical information I wanted to share. So as I said, you know, with the DBE program, it's a remedy for smaller businesses, women-owned firms who are working their way up. So we typically will use these kind of slides to one, coach the DBEs of why it's important for them if they are going through this process, the benefits of certification. We go through the process, the eligibility portion as well, and it's, you know, from what we've seen, there's been an uptick in requests over the last, I'd say, probably two or three years of more firms wanting to do work here in Alaska. So this, like I said, for me and our staff as well too, this is just one of the slides we typically will use because we want to make sure we're covering all the bases. Primarily, one of the questions we will get a lot is what's the benefit of becoming certified as a DBE.
We have more questions. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I guess just to follow up on, after this slide kind of got my mind thinking on my previous question, what is to stop a business from just making a female 51% owner and she doesn't do anything, but she's 51% on paper? Like, how would you stop them from taking advantage of this program?
Great question. What we typically, when we do our DBE onboarding, we talk about fraud. We see it a lot. There's potential for that exact thing to happen, is for them to go through the entire process and have the wife, if you will, as the front, and you know, her brother and her dad are actually doing the work. So the paperwork for the on-site is very important, right? The certification agent, even if they're there and they feel like, no, something's not right, if she's operating the machinery, she doesn't know how to start it, doesn't know how to move it, those are all red flags, and we can deny them.
Follow up. Yeah, and what if they just make her 51% owner and with no expectation? You know, for example, I can even think of an example of, you know, like if a husband and wife start a business and he passed away, and so she would be 51% owner with no expectation of really doing anything in the business that's continuing to run. You see what I'm saying? So that's kind of a parallel there. Yep. I'm assuming that when you're doing this, you get access to, like, financial records as well, because that would kind of verify that 51% of the money is actually going to who's 51% owner. Is that kind of how that happens?
Correct. Yeah, we get tax records, financial records. We essentially take a deep dive into their lives. I mean, very, 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 very deep dive into their lives.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the Co-Chair, good to see you. I had a question also about DBE. So I was looking through the U.S. DOT issuing an interim final rule that removed race and gender from the social disadvantage aspects. So I'm curious how that rule has impacted the DBE businesses in this state.
So it's catastrophically messed a lot of things up, actually. Very, very bad. So what we are currently in the process of doing is recertifying the majority of the firms that that were typically a DBE. And what they have to now show is their personal narrative of how he or she were disadvantaged, whether it's lack of education, lack of resources, where they grew up, just a multitude of different things. And then with there being no real guidance on the federal side, each form that I review, each one is different. So it's massively up into the program.
Follow up through the coach. Yeah, that sounds like a lot of bureaucracy. So it sounds like before it was more of, was it more of a checking the box type of situation? And now you're doing more of a qualitative analysis of how someone or their ownership is socially disadvantaged?
I wouldn't use the term checking the box. It was just a methodic process that we have, and then we got guidance from the feds. Now it's just the interim final rule has come out, and now you can't use race and gender. You have to show a different way of how you've been disadvantaged. So like I said, any form that we get, each one is different because, you know, John Smith is from someplace, and he experienced this, and this person experienced this. So each one we've gotten so far is very different.
One more follow-up. Through the co-chair, are you getting more DBE applicants because of that?
No.
Okay. Thank
so
you.
I have a follow-up on that. So if they're going through the process of recertification, do they have to initiate that process, or is the office initiating that process for folks who may no longer qualify?
Yeah, great question. So when the IFR came out on October 3rd, what we quickly did was put a message out to all the firms, and then we've provided up till now three trainings on what you're supposed to do and just kind of constant communication to the firms. And it's essentially now up to the firms to either say, I want to still be in the program or not.
Okay. Thank you. We're going to take just a very brief at ease because my co-chair has rejoined us, and he is chairing today. At ease.
We're back on the record, and sorry to the committee for another event kept me from being here on time. So thank you, and this can continue with our presentation, sir, Mr. Johnson. Joseph, I should say.
So next, I'll continue on with the DBE program. So another sub-program within the DBE program is our ACDBE program. And as you see on the slide, it's Airport Concession Disadvantaged Business Enterprise Program. So with the ACDBE program is very unique in that any business that you see within the airport, we're responsible for a massive amount of outreach to ensure that small businesses, not only in Alaska but nationwide, have the opportunity to be certified as an ACDBE, whether in their home state or in our state, and that there's opportunities at the airport for any one of these small businesses. As of late, this has probably been on the federal side for FAA, one of our top programs as they look more into Alaska in terms of the rural airport system and understanding the potential for small businesses out in the rural airports. And as you see here too, as well, you know, with the objective for the ACDBE program is similar to our DBE program, just in terms of trying to leverage or give a small business an opportunity to obtain work at the airports. So types of concessions, we typically show and kind of teach on any concession that's making money in the airport is a potential ACDBE, as we are now working through a federal compliance review now. We now know some things such as newspaper stands, the trikes that you see at some airports, really essentially any and everything that's in an airport can now be considered an ACDBE. We've gone through a pretty lengthy process as of late, going through quite a few of our rural airports just to know and see and have an inventory. Okay, what's at these airports, whether it's, you know, Ted Stevens or Fairbanks all the way up to Nome. We've gone out to Unalakleet. We go out to a bunch of different places just to kind of see what's in the airport. And the FAA wants to know that we know what's actually in the airport. Certification process similar to the DBE program. If John Smith comes in and he wants to operate a vending machine, or he's certified as one of his codes for his ACDBE, we'll understand he's an ACDBE. He's looking for work at one of our airports and work do it that way. The compliance and reporting for the FAA specifically is very, very cumbersome. They want to see the amount of money that these ACDBEs are generating. In a bigger picture, how this affects our agency is that when the reports are off, we do run the risk of, I'd say, having federal funds withheld. It's one of the smaller pieces, one of the nuances of our program that a lot of people don't understand or know. So, and like I said, similar to with the DBE program, it opens up opportunity because the firms know that our agents, well, most if not all state agencies have a DBE goal. With the new interim final rule that kind of puts everything at a standstill until the firms are certified. But like I said, you know, these firms take on quite a bit to become certified, and once they are through the certification phase of it, they do have a lot of opportunities, whether it's a partnership. One of the big ones we see nationwide is HMS Host typically will help a lot of smaller agencies or a lot of smaller businesses, whether it's training them on how to operate in the airport and those kind of things. Please proceed. Our SBEC program is just is as you see on the slide, the small business element concession. This is our program where we essentially will help, and I don't want to say guide a business into how to operate their business, but one of the main things we do with the SBEC program is when a firm comes in, one of the main questions we ask them is, what are your goals, and show us your business plan, because typically a lot of these smaller firms don't know where to start, but then also contracting opportunities and those kind of things. They don't really understand how to make a bid, how to get DOT work. So for our SBEC program, it's just that it's almost like an agency within our office that we help grow these businesses there too. And then, as the same with our DBE program, you know, we want to show that, you know, the certification process, which scares off a lot of potential firms, but also just the benefits of the program as well too.
I had a question, Mr. Joseph. So, what I heard you say, just if you can just correct my thinking if it's wrong, if you have a concession come in and they need a little bit of help navigating the system, you provide that assistance. You might make comments on their, say, business plan, so on and so forth. Is that correct?
To the co-chair, Aishad, yes, sir.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. I'm sure that's appreciated by folks that come in without all the information.
Mm-hmm. So as I said at the start, we do have multiple different sections within our office. Typically, when people hear Civil Rights Office, they instantly think Civil Rights Act of 1964. They think it's they are right. That is the flagship of our programs, and they instantly think, you know, non-discrimination and those kind of deals, but not understanding that within our office we also have our OJT program, which is on-the-job training program. I think it's pretty much a pretty big, I'd say, a workforce development tool is what we use it for. As you can see in this picture here, this is at one of our conferences. So we host probably one of the biggest job fairs within the state. We bring high schools from all over the state to Anchorage, and we have what is called Alaska Construction Career Day. We rent out the fairgrounds and just kind of bring in private sector, public sector, the military, just quite a few things, and then have on the job training booths and skills happening there. This year we have more heavy welding, NDT, so non-destructive testing, crane operators, and that kind of thing coming out too. So like I said, when people hear civil rights, they don't understand, which is kind of, you know, why we love doing these types of things, because a lot of people don't know within the Civil Rights Office we actually do on-the-job training, business development, and those kind of things too. We also have a Title VI program. So this is our program where we look at all of the aspects of what the DOT does, whether it's on the Marine Highway System, the aviation side, and also on our construction side. With this program, this is probably one of the most stringent ones that we have, just because all the federal modes, when we are doing our annual reports, they're looking for, has the DOT discriminated anywhere in the state with any work, systems, service, and that kind of thing as well too. And then we have our ADA program. That's just what it is, our Americans with Disabilities Act. This is probably one of the busiest programs we have, just because with the amount of responsibility for the DOT, what this program does is it helps us ensure that everything that the DOT is doing, it's accessible by all. So whether it's us doing an evaluation at the ferry stops, on the ferries, at the airports, or really even during active construction sites, we have teams of people who go out and just do spot checks as well. So as I said, we house the OJT program. So we work with a lot of different agencies throughout the state, really being able to help a woman or minority that's in the construction trade with just a lot of different things. You know, we had a program a little while ago that was federally funded that we would purchase boots, work belts, and like the first entry level of stuff, right? Because we typically will get a person who's either in a union, they've left this union out, now they're trying something new, and so it's almost like a starter pack to get to get the person into work.
And I had a question on the job training. You had mentioned in the previous slide this job fair, and I was just curious, how many, when was your last one? How many people participated, and what were the ages, age range of participants, just to give a sense of this scale?
Good question. Through the chair, so the last one was last year. It was in, I think I'm going to say, late May. We had 700 students there. We also have been able to bring in some adults as well, too. Our next one is actually next week, and we think right now we have 750 students registered.
And where is that located next week, and what day, if you have that?
Through the chair, Aisha, it is April 8th, and it's going to be at the Alaska Fairgrounds.
Yeah, and age range? Is it high school students mostly?
Through the chair, Aisha, yes, high school. Last year, I wanted to incorporate middle school, so we've, I'd say, 12 to 19, if you will.
Yeah. That's just fantastic. Yeah. I'm a former teacher, and I serve on the education committee, and we talk a lot about career and technical education. Oh. So fantastic. Glad to hear this.
Going on to our ADA program, this, like I said, this is probably one of the more stringent ones that the federal folks look at us for. So a part of this program is what we have an ADA transition plan. You're required to have them. What those plans do is say what the DOT will do, whether it's curb ramp, sidewalks, four-way intersections, access at the airport, access in the airport, access at the ferry's terminal stops, and access on the ferries is something that we monitor, report on, as well as help help the agency when we're contacted. What we typically will see is personnel will call us and say the sidewalks. I mean, as we all live here, know ton of snow all over the place. One of the primary things our ADA team does is essentially drive around whenever we have a snow dump. They'll drive around to make sure there's access at the bus stops, whether it's a city road or state road. We do have counterparts at the Muni and Anchorage. But we also will contact our M&O crews. There's been times where we've had people, I don't want to say stranded, but we've had people in electric wheelchairs in the roads. And so for us, especially if it's a state road, it's almost an immediate red flag. We get called on it all the time. And so I'll work with our communication personnel or M&O staff saying, hey, here's the regulation. Technically, the sidewalk needs to be cleaned. Obviously, we understand and know we have a street maintenance schedule as well. But I think, with this program particularly, we're able to act very fast to contact whether it's our communication staff, the construction staff, or the M&O folks to make sure, especially when there's a snow dump within that first 48 hours, if it's an area we know that has, people with disabilities or bus routes, to contact the meeting. Hey, this is what we typically get. Let's make sure these areas are clean. We work with the governor's disability advisory group. We work with them on quite a bit of things just to understand what they're experiencing or what they're hearing as well too.
And Mr. Joseph, a question related to that. So that's something I hear representing Anchorage a fair amount. Mm-hmm. Especially, we've had a pretty decent winter snow-wise. So I really am super pleased that you drive around and you're identifying issues and letting the proper folks, whether it's DOT or the Muni, know about the issue. Do you take calls from the public regarding that? Like someone, I don't want to open you up to something, but what I really would like to know is what can I tell my constituents when they see there's a bus stop that's inaccessible or you know, simply a sidewalk that it's been a while since the last snow or snow plow has plowed snow into it. It's inaccessible to mm-hmm. folks, say, in a wheelchair. Who do we call?
Through the chair, Aisha, it would be our office. We take calls from the public all the time. It's almost like clockwork. As soon as we get a massive snow dump, we typically will get a couple of calls, and then we route them, whether it's to the M&O staff, or we just kind of walk through the process of telling the person, hey, this is what we can and will do. So we take calls from the public all the time.
I appreciate that because yeah. Now I can refer my constituents to somebody.
So. please do.
So thank you. Co-Chair Carey.
Thank you, through the co-chair. So I know ADA Title II and Section 504 are federal laws and mandates that we have. Can you talk about what funding sources outside of federal funding the office has access to? And I'll give you an example. So the Governor's Council on Disabilities mm-hmm. has a priority right now to install more universal changing tables across mm-hmm. Alaska and have more restroom facilities be more accessible for people with disabilities. But I don't think it's currently in these federal laws. Mm-hmm. So it's to some extent aspirational.
Yeah.
What resources are available for folks that want to for the ability for DOT to add that into the scope of work on some of these projects?
Great question, through the chair, Carrick. So for us, we use the consequence of losing federal funds if we don't have these things, right? So for our ADA program, the funding that we do get for that is for ADA upgrades throughout the entire state. For those kind of situations, in the example you've given, we typically will see when we go through a review, more so primarily at the airports, those changing tables and that kind of and that kind of thing. When they do the walkthrough of the airport, those are things that we note. A big one now is having the changing table in male bathrooms now as well. I think that's kind of taken a life of its own over the last probably 2 years is what we've seen an uptick in when we go look at all these airports. So I'd say for funding wise, it's the threat of losing the federal funds. Right. So when we get told from someone, hey, we can't do this because A, B, or C, we just point back to our Title II requirements and our Section 504 requirements. And then the consequence if we don't have these things.
Just a quick follow-up. And I don't – so the universal changing tables are so adults can also use
yeah.
them. And mm-hmm. I don't think they're currently mandated by ADA. I guess that would be a question, but I'm seeing you're shaking your head. But when we have, you know, these kinds of upgrades that maybe aren't technically in the law and yet they're a high priority for mm-hmm. Ensuring accessibility, what opportunities, I guess, exist through your office to help kind of support some of that work?
Yeah. Through the chair, Carrick, the opportunities for us in those situations – I think would point directly to us contacting our facilities personnel if there's an upgrade that would then have to abide by whatever the standard is for the building and then add that in there. I don't know. I mean, it would probably be a federal grant, I would think, that would have to happen for that to actually happen, like special money for those tables, because I haven't really seen anything on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah. Just wanted to ask.
Okay, and just for the record, Representative Holland joined us at 1:42 p.m. Welcome. And Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. My question, I'm not familiar with the ADA outside of requirements during construction on either materials or measurements of certain things. But I see here it says applies during all construction phases as far as ensuring safe and equal access for the public. How is that possible or enforceable? I mean, it's just something that I've never thought of before. This is the first time I ever saw that it was required during mm-hmm. all phases of construction. How do you enforce that? If that's actually what it says,
mm-hmm.
how are you not pinching every construction site, basically?
Through through the chair, Nelson, that's actually exactly what we do. So throughout the phase of that construction site, so one area that we really look at is an alternate route, right? Because if there's a construction project going on, if I'm a person with a disability, I still need to get through that construction site. So we actually drive around and look at these construction sites and look for where's the alternate route. And so when we don't find it, we take a picture, we'll contact our traffic safety folks and say, hey, violation A, B, or C, here's what and why.
Follow up? Yeah, thank you. Great clarification. That makes total sense to me. I thought it was talking, I didn't know if it applied to the construction site. So I'm sorry, I'm just like, what in the world? It's way more sense now. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think later on in the presentation we'll have some pictures of good things and bad things. So thank you. Please proceed.
So here are the standards that we use. So PROAG and ADAG is what we do everything off of. And when we go in the field, when our staff's in the field, we have certain charts that we use for different types of sidewalks, four-way intersections and that kind of deal. And so what's great about our ADA program, it's these standards are airtight. I mean, there's certain areas in the state where there's some leniency from the federal side, particularly in the southeast or down here, if you will. But outside of that, these standards are pretty much set in stone. What we've seen in the Ketchikan area, just because the roads are so sloped and different, we've been able to get infeasibility reports approved. And so that's typically in the only times or places that we actually will see that.
And let me just for the public that might be listening, you know, some acronyms here. These accessibility standards, PROAG stands for Public Right-of-Way Accessibility Guidelines, and ADAG is Americans with Disabilities Act Accessibility Guidelines, and they're a little different. So, Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Chair Eichheit. So we're just talking about construction here, right? Because if you ever go to the top of Gold Street.
that's a local street here.
The top of Gold Street up
in
here
Juneau.
Is like you'd never get a wheelchair up that
the hill.
Or down there. It.
Or down it, yeah. Down it might be fun, actually.
So through the chair, McCabe, yes, it's through construction and even after. So in our construction season, when a firm says, yes, we've completed strip, you know, whatever it's going to be, we will actually go do spot checks. We have staff who come here. We travel all over the entire state. So, and we know where all these projects are happening. So like I said, it's during construction. And then after as well, too, because they'll sign, you know, we've seen at times where firms will sign off and say, yes, we are done with this four-way intersection or these curb ramps. We go put level to it, and it's not to any of these standards here. So then they have to come back, rip it all out, and then redo it.
Follow-up?
Yeah, thanks, through the chair. I'm curious, what if you get to a place like up where I live right now at the top of Gold Street and you have to rebuild a road? I mean, are you going to now have to comply with all this? Because I think if you ever had to comply with this, we would build nothing there. Mm-hmm. You know, little tiny streets, little tiny sidewalks, 10 to 12 degree slope or something like that. I mean, it's significant. Mm-hmm. How would you ever do that for a new construction up there? Maybe the better question is, if you were just updating up there, if you were repaving or doing some work up there, and I get that it's probably not state, but... would you have to comply with this, or is there a certain amount of it that's grandfathered in just based on the previous construction up there?
Through the chair, McCabe. So when it's not state, I'm not too sure what the munis do for state. When we do a road, the sidewalk is then upgraded to these standards as well.
Wow. Cool.
And a question kind of related to this, you know, excuse my ignorance, but you know, I notice on a lot of times when we build a new state highway, we redo a section of highway. They put in the paved trails off on the side. And is that a part of any of these accessibility guidelines? Because, you know, these are highways that don't have sidewalks. You know, they go through rural areas. But especially when they're in more urbanized or populated areas, is like, oh, look at, they're putting in this side trail, and I'm just, you know, a paved trail, which I love. I use those things, but is that part of these accessibility standards?
Through the chair, Aishad, yes. So what we are doing now is taking a deeper look at the trails that the state's responsible for. I think we have a new section within the DOT that we're working with now for accessibility on those trails, too.
Okay, thank you. I didn't know that, so thank you. Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So, this kind of leads to another question, probably that your office deals with. So in where I normally live, we have these wonderful bike trails and walking trails right along the state road that never get plowed in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. So would that be an ADA thing? Hello, Andy.
through the chair, McKay, yes. If it's on, I'd say if it's state operated, we are responsible for that.
Follow up. Thanks. So I can just have the RSA call your office, and we would get better, faster plowing of our bike trails that are walking.
Through the chair, McCabe, I would take the call and contact. I would take the call and contact the M&O staff and say, hey, we're getting called and told there's a trail that's inaccessible.
Good to know. Thank you.
And just to add to that, I know the paved trail along the Glen Highway, just as you leave Anchorage, they plow that.
Yeah.
And in the spring during breakup, I run on that because it's plowed. It melts off sooner when the greenbelt trails are glare ice. And so for about two to three weeks, I will drive over to Bartlett High School Park and I run on that trail because it's a paved trail. It's clear. And so I really appreciate them plowing it in the winter.
So what is PROAG? So it's essentially the law that governs sidewalks, crosswalks, shared use paths, on street parking, pedestrian signals. So this is where we get our standards and our measurements and everything else from, pertaining to the compliance side of our paths and crosswalks. So I think there's ties to the question that was just asked. You know, when a highway is built, is the sidewalk then upgraded? So with these PROAG standards now being adopted, when there is a new roadway intersection that's built, the curb ramps and everything within that section have to be built into the most current update. So that's your curb ramps, signals, sidewalks, and all must comply. So when in our office, we have interns who travel throughout the entire state getting all of this information. So we track this information through our ArcGIS real-time tracking as well, too. And so what this does is it allows the public to actually see new construction that's planned, pictures of the new intersections and that kind of deal. It's been a tool that's helped us a lot on our federal compliance side, because at the time when FHW here had a civil rights specialist, he or she could actually go into ArcGIS and see the actual, not only the measurements, but see the physical picture as well, too. So, like I said, you know, with PROAG, it helps immensely, I feel, because any of the new construction, and I keep saying that, but it's bringing everything up to a newer standard. So even, I think there was a question earlier about, you know, an old road, and it's, you know, the road's getting built, or the sidewalks getting built, but what PROAG does, it kind of forces contractors and everyone else that when there's anything that's built, it has to be built within these new standards. So this ties to some of the questions I think I feel like I heard earlier, just in terms of our bus stops and these kind of deals. So primarily for us with the bus stops, we track data for state roads and city roads. We also track that data with picture images. So in the event that we do get a complaint or we get someone calling, we can say, hey, we went to the bus stop. It's built to these standards. We don't really have this type of bus stop here. This is something you see in other states, but we also will train personnel on when we go to construction fairs and those kind of deals of what technically a feasible bus stop supposed to look like? So this ties to the question earlier about the construction zone. Like I said, this is something we actively during construction season drive around and just watch the construction sites to make sure there is an acceptable pedestrian alternate route, and that's including the signage that actually says alternate route. It can't just be like a cardboard. Cardboard piece slanted. It actually has to be up to these standards. So here are some examples of what we've been able to see around town. Like I said, we travel all over the state. Primarily, one of the big ones that we see are these two, especially when there's road work going on. That one you see there on the right with that. Where it says XO closed, typically contractors will just put those in the walkway, not understanding that they are technically required to have an alternate route. The one you see there on the left is one we see all over the state as well. Because, you know, for us, we look at it through a lens of, if I had a disability and I'm walking through here, could I actively get through here? We've taken some steps as well, too, on airport projects. We actually will walk with an organization we work with a lot, Blind and Visually Impaired. We walk with them, walk behind them, I'm sorry, just to kind of envision or see what they see or what they're feeling as they move through our construction zones. So, like I said, not having a cardboard there or gravel strung across the road, these are just examples of when we walk around to get these pictures of what not to do or what can happen. Because we do have pedestrians that will take these pictures and call or make a complaint. And that's just a bigger issue, not only for us, but for the contractor as well. Worst case scenario, you know, in some of these situations, the state could actually be sued. This is what we do like to see in terms of an alternate route. You see there in the middle picture, it says, has a detour, clear sign there. Also, the walkway area that you see on that far left, when it has the gates on the side to allow, it's a clear delineation of an alternate route.
Mr. Joseph, curious, when you show up on a construction site, are people happy you're there? I'm talking about the construction crew or the foreman. Or do you have I'm sure you know most of the people building these various projects. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Through the chair, Aishad, no, they don't. So typically, they don't know we're there until we either call the foreman or there's an issue. So it used to be when we showed up, it was the bad guys. Now that we've kind of trained on, we're here to help the agency, but also the company, and ultimately, we don't want them to be sued, right? Because that's where it leads to.
So you're working with folks to help them comply and meet everyone's needs.
Through the chair, Aishad, yes.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Great. Representative Nelson?
Yeah, I don't know. Thank you, Co-Chair Aishad. I don't know if it has anything to do with ADA, but those guys might get sued for the height of their fire hydrants on the picture on the left.
No.
Just a thought.
Inaccessible. Thank you. I had not noticed that, Representative Nelson, so thank you.
So this slide here is just an overview of what we train on as we go out to meet with the crews or even at the construction spring flings that we have throughout the state. We just kind of train on certain things that the crews are responsible for doing. Here's some of our staff at two of our events that we've gone to. So also within our Title VI program, as we transition out of ADA to Title VI, the public engagement requirements are extremely important. This is a tool that essentially the feds want to see what is the DOT doing in terms of communicating where the projects are, what's happening with these projects, and not only what are we doing. They want to see active engagement. So we work with our communications department quite a bit. But as you can see there, we have two of our staff, well, it's three actually, at some of our big events. And really, it's just kind of educating the public, right? It's educating the public on you have someone to call. There are avenues that we have to communicate throughout the state, just on a variety of things. So as these projects go, we get a lot of different questions of how can I be involved. We go to open houses all the time, not only just to kind of make sure the DOT is doing what we're supposed to, but also holding these meetings at times to where the community can actually take part in the meeting. So it's a couple of steps more than just public engagement. It's okay, we're actually looking at what time is this meeting being held. You know, I could give an example of Mountain View, Fairview area in Anchorage. If meetings are being held at 10 o'clock in the morning, the community there probably is not going to be there. The actual folks that are being affected by our project may not be there, whether it's because lack of transportation, dual jobs, or working. And so it's more than just public engagement. It's how we're engaging, when we're engaging, and what's actually being shared. Because those are the things that the feds are trying to figure out from a civil rights standpoint.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So just looking at this, it just occurred to me, actually, are you involved with the PF portion of DOT and PF as well? So all the public facilities, you have to ensure ADA compliance of the restrooms and the walkways and the stairs and everything?
Through the Chair McCabe, yes.
Well, hence the large size of the office. You probably don't think it's large.
And Representative Mina.
Thank you, Co-Chair Aisha. Through the Co-Chair, I actually had a call from someone recently about wanting to create a parallel structure to what we have in Anchorage, where we have our Public Transit Advisory Board. Mm-hmm. There's one seat that's dedicated to someone with a disability or maybe somebody from that community or who works in that field, and that person wanting a similar structure on the state. DOT and public facilities is a huge department, so you have a ton of different projects. But I'm curious, with your public engagement, is there like a dedicated seat or a way where someone with a disability can provide input on a project where maybe it might not violate ADA, but just so that there's a dedicated role and space for that perspective?
Yeah. Great question. Through the chair, Mina. So our ADA program manager, who you see on this picture here, Rose Pierre Howard, we would be able to take the comments, but we would take those comments specifically with on the ADA side. So if it were a volunteer position, we would take any and all comments to the project managers. Because I think what typically will happen is you'll have individuals with disabilities and they're experiencing something that's different than what the project plan says or the scope of the work says. And so I think typically when we get those kind of calls, it just depends on the project, where they are in the process of the project. I do know other state agencies sometimes will have a volunteer force, but that's just something we don't have.
Follow up through the co-chair, do you do report outs to, I guess, organizations that serve people with disabilities, like the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education or Key Coalition? I'm just trying to figure, like, when you spoke about trying to meet people where they are, mm-hmm. what are the other organizations where you do report out on bigger projects that might impact those communities?
Through the chair, Mina, we don't report out to them, but we try to work with them on all things. So I think the Governor's Disability Council, they have a monthly meeting. Our ADA team, they go to that meeting. And so we try to hear what people are experiencing so we can take that information back to said department.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And just for the record, Senator Rob Myers joined us at 2:01 p.m. Welcome. And we want to wrap this up if we can pretty soon. I think we're almost to the end.
Public notice requirements here. And so all this is like I said, when we attend these events, we typically will go look for certain things to ensure that at public hearings, the right equipment is there. And also a big thing of what we're seeing as of late is you're really just ensuring that in the event that we need translation services, that's something that we can actually have there and provide as well too. And then on our 504 stuff is just in terms of emails, mail outs that we do, just really working with our communication department to say, hey, also, like I said, in the event that we know a certain populations in the area, let's make sure we can have on hand, if needed, translation services. And this is just our non-discrimination policy statement. We check periodically throughout the entire state on any of the notices that go out the bottom of web pages, contracts, really any and all things that our DOT is doing. We check, like I said, periodically to make sure that this is the most current language we have on there. Contract-wise, the feds, when we do have reviews, they go directly to a certain section to make sure that this is all in there. And like I said, another big part of what we do is that community engagement piece. Because our office is more so externally facing, we do a lot of work in the community. I mean, a lot. We have staff who spend numerous hours on the weekends at events. And it's just to be that go-between from the public to the DOT and is taking any of those kind of concerns back to said department. And that is all I have. Thank you guys for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Joseph. Do we have any final questions for Mr. Joseph? Thank you. I would just then like to add that this, I think the genesis of your presentation came out of last June, if my memory is correct. I went to the Juneteenth event mm-hmm. in Anchorage and Delaney Park Strip and was looking at all the different booths, and I remember seeing yours and said Civil Rights Division of Alaska DOT, and I had never heard of that. So I immediately went over and engaged, and I thought it would be quite appropriate to learn more what you do, and I really appreciate some of the information you gave us. I didn't realize the Americans with Disabilities Act work that you do and how you can assist us in keeping our sidewalks clear for folks. And so I really appreciate you coming today, and, mm-hmm. and thank you, sir, for your good work.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you, guys.
Okay. So we have a little less than an hour left. I see we recognize Representative Holland before. And Representative Holland, I think you have House Bill 317, Wildland Urban Interface Maintenance Plan. So would you like to come forward, please, put yourself and your staff person, Aiden, on the record? And but we're going to take a brief at ease as you get ready there to get the presentation up. Right, at ease. back on the record after we got our presentation up. So, Representative Holland, if you and your staff person would like to put yourself on the record and tell us about House Bill 317, DOT Critical Route Prioritization. It's hard for me to say.
Right. Thank you, Co-Chair Eichheide. Kai Holland, I represent House District 9 in Anchorage. This is the South Anchorage Hillside area. It includes the Basher-Stuckingen Heights area south, extending into Turnagain Arm up to Whittier. A lot of the area with the hillside has been an area of wildfire interest and concern over the years. House Bill 317 that we're introducing today is a bill that is a fairly straightforward bill to begin with, but it represents a important area of work. The bill does two things. One is it adds to the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities duties a new duty related to looking at how the department can identify, prioritize, and in the future look at the maintenance of roads in wildland urban interface areas. The second thing that it does is it provides an uncodified language, the guidance for the department to look further into how to develop a plan for the maintenance of the roads, specifically targeted at roads that lead to isolated residential areas that only have one route in and out. And in looking at that, to come up with a report to the legislature by December of this year. So it's adding a duty to look at the wildfire urban interface area where roads go through, and is looking at developing a plan of what that might mean longer term to do that maintenance. A little bit of background then, backing up on where this comes from and what it's intended to address. This single route issue came to my attention because of a number of roads that exist in House District 9, but I've found exist in many other areas that are on the road system where we have an isolated residential area, in my case, Bear Valley, or it could be Glen Alps, or it could be Basher-Stuckingen Heights, where there's one single route that goes to that neighborhood area, and it goes through an area with a lot of vegetation, and is an area identified as part of the wildland-urban interface and an area of high risk of wildfires. The work that we've done in this area has been now developed into the most recent updated Community Wildfire Protection Plan, CWPP, to recognize that this issue is an important issue for the CWPP work and an area that needs attention in terms of the work that needs to be done. However, what I ran into is that we really don't have a policy structure by which to do this work. And with the most recent functional classification update, one of the areas I ran into was in looking at the functional classifications, the question of how did wildfires and the classification, particularly of minor and major collector roads going through WUI areas, how was that functional classification impacted by WUI wildfire risk? And the reality was there was no structure for that issue to be prioritized. So this bill, again, is bringing visibility to the wildfire issue, and it is, I hope, providing some framework for the department to be able to look at this issue and help provide us some guidance and direction down the road on plans and funding to support this work. If we go back a little bit on this, and if we are looking at 2006, there was a significant amount of wildfire-related fire mitigation work done, particularly in the hillside area. And at that point in time, we did a shaded fuel break along Clark's Road, which is a road leading to Bear Valley. And at that point in time, they had identified that this single route to this isolated neighborhood needed to be thinned out in terms of vegetation along it. And so they constructed a 250-foot wide shaded fuel break in order to provide a way to not remove all the vegetation or trees, but to eliminate a number of them so that it would be a place where if there was ever a fire, it would quiet down and allow that area to help defend the neighborhood as well as ensure that the road would continue to function safely. That was done in 2006. Funding ran out, and it wasn't actually completed. There was a portion of that that was left still fully vegetated. Now, zoom forward to 2018. We had the Paradise Campfire in California. And in that fire, there was a tremendous loss of life, almost 18,000 structures lost, and almost 100 people. And when I looked into that, I realized that the hillside was potentially another paradise fire in terms of the relative lack of roads and infrastructure and the danger that could exist if we had a major fire and emergency vehicles couldn't get in and people evacuating couldn't get out. And so we began looking into this issue, and we realized we had a lot of these roads that went into these isolated areas. We did some initial work and passed a bond in Anchorage in 2020 that provided some initial funding to start looking at some road connections that needed to be made, and that includes the Mountain Air project that's still going on right now in South Anchorage. And in 2022, we got some additional funding from the legislature to look at the egress problem. And through Dr. Jen Schmidt at ICER, a study was completed that looked at roads from Eagle River around through the hillside area to identify where we had these isolated roads. And she did some additional modeling of if we had to evacuate a bunch of people out of these roads, were they going to function properly in terms of getting the intersections to work and people to get in and out and the vegetation along them to create high-risk areas. This helped inform us and then, again, then fed into the CWPP. And then finally, the Clark's Road project comes back. There was a project in 2024 to do some more fuel mitigation along that last section that hadn't been done before. And I discovered in the process of doing that that there was a couple dead spruce trees in the right-of-way. And I spent the next year and a half trying to figure out how to get those dead spruce trees taken down, and that began the work for trying to come up with a policy to give us some direction and the opportunity for the department to work on a plan long term. So I've given you kind of a little bit of history. I'd like to turn it over to staff, to Aiden Nickel, who will kind of walk through the actual bill and some of the background, and then also to note that we've got from the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, Andy Mills here, who is also a resource if there are questions for the department.
And Representative Holland, do you prefer to have questions directed to you now after your staffer is done? What's your preference, sir?
Co-chair Eichheit, either way is fine with me. Just kind of monitor your pace.
Okay.
When you'd like to get done. I'm comfortable to let this go.
Yeah, Representative McCabe does have a question. Do you want to pose that now, sir?
Yeah, thanks, Chair Eichheit. So, Representative Holland, so I'm curious about the definition of urban. Because if you look at some federal definitions, all of Alaska is considered rural. So I'm kind of questioning what you consider urban. And a second follow-up question would kind of be, shouldn't this be handled in city zoning? Shouldn't there always be a secondary exit? In other words, when they built Bear Valley, and maybe they don't require it now, but maybe if they build any other subdivisions, there should be a secondary exit, right? And is Clark's, maybe a third question, is Clark's Road a DOT road? Is it? Okay.
So through the chair, back to Representative McCabe, backing up, Clark's Road is a state road, at least a portion of it, and this particular portion of it that had these dead spruce trees was a state section of road. In terms of should this be a zoning issue, in terms of having multiple access points, I think it is, and indeed Anchorage does now have requirements for development that goes on to have secondary egress routes on there. However, we continue to approve new developments where we waive waive that requirement. So that's definitely an issue, and I think that's a preferred solution. In terms of the definition of urban, I think to be clear here, we're talking about wildland-urban interfaces, and that's a fairly technical area of definition. I would generally defer to the Department of Natural Resources and Division of Forestry, but there is specific methodology around how that is defined, and in particular where there's high wildfire risk. So it's a matter of looking at the proximity of the built structure and the vegetation, and the city has adopted a formal wildland-urban interface, and the DNR and Division of Forestry have other areas around the state that have been designated as having a wildland-urban interface that I would defer to them in terms of their definition, because I know that that's been changing and there's a new definition that's being updated right now.
Yeah, so please proceed. And then, you know, just for everyone's awareness, we do have Judy Chapman, Deputy Director of Planning for DOT, online as well. So please proceed.
Thank you, Co-Chair Eichheit. For the record, Aiden Nickel, staff to Representative Holland. We're going to start by offering some visuals to illustrate the hazards that Representative Holland was describing earlier, and that this bill is targeted at addressing. So this is Clark's Road on the Anchorage Hillside in our district. As a reminder, this is the only route in and out of the Bear Valley neighborhood, which has several hundred residents. Those orange arrows there on the left indicate the dead spruce trees that Representative Holland worked for a year and a half to remove. And you can see, based on their proximity to the road, that in a situation where there are high winds and a fire that is spreading fast, this could be a serious issue. If these trees go down as a fire is growing, that's going to inhibit emergency responders' ability to reach the scene of a fire, and it's going to slow down residents' evacuation. And it's important to emphasize that the Clark's Road case in our district is an illustrative example, but it is far from the only example of this issue in the state. In nearly every residential area on the road system, we have neighborhoods that are accessible by only a single route. So all of these examples listed here from the interior, from the Matsu, from the Kenai Peninsula, are state-maintained roads that access residential areas that could become critical egress routes for residents and access routes for emergency responders in the case of a wildfire. So the solution that this legislation proposes is a prioritization framework that recognizes that the particular risks and particular needs of each of these communities are different, from the road surface to the frequency of wildfires in an area. And in order to keep both costs as low as possible and to have the work done as thoroughly as possible, House Bill 317 integrates this work into existing systems. It requires that the prioritization list be developed in consultation with municipalities and local experts, and our goal is when that maintenance takes place towards wildfire mitigation goals, it happens as a part of DOT's existing maintenance rotation. And we do have an existing model for this work. In the fiscal year 2023 budget, the legislature included intent language similar to the language in this bill, requiring DOT to create a prioritization system for winter maintenance and snow removal, partnering with municipalities. Moving into the sectional analysis, Section 1 amends DOT's powers and duties, adding to its responsibilities that it must create a prioritization program for maintenance of its facilities in WUI wildland urban interface areas. Section 2 adds new uncodified language requiring the department to create this program. As part of the program, the department is required to create and maintain, in partnership with local entities, a list of state roads prioritized for wildfire mitigation work, and the department is required to report to the legislature on this work. And with that, Co-Chair Eichheit, I'd like to turn it back over to Representative Holland before we welcome the committee's questions. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Are there questions, Representative McCabe?
Maybe just a statement. Are those trees still up there? I mean, I got a chainsaw. I'm happy to come help. We can do it in about 20 minutes instead of 18 months.
Through the co-chair, they are down, as a matter of fact. But I will note as a little bit of background here. In 2024, when we first were working on this project, Team Rubicon had volunteered to come in and do some work in our neighborhood. And they said, where's the project? And we said, well, here's this section of Clark's Road that had not been treated a couple 20 years ago. And we said, it would be a huge help if you could help us clean this area out. Well, as things turned out, it got complicated in terms of different rights of way and different permits. And they weren't able to do that as a Team Rubicon project, but I didn't give up on it. And we had identified these trees. And in working with the central region, I found that, and I learned about this rotation of right-of-way maintenance that DOT does, and that Clark's Road was scheduled to be in the rotation for maintenance the following year, 2025, a year later. So I kind of, you know, said, well, can't we get these down now? But there was no funding to do that or mechanism to do that. So the year went on. Meanwhile, the LRSA, local road service area, had offered to just come take care of it. But we were trying to work with everybody. There was Parks Department, Great Land Trust, there was DOT, and the LRSA all involved, and the community council. And I was trying to figure out, well, how do we do this? So I let this play out. And the next summer, it is now 2025, I said, aha, this is the year that this road is in the cycle of work for right-of-way work. And along comes a, you know, an impressive effort that did a lot of the ditch cleaning and cleaned out all the culverts and ditches. I said, well, can we get these two trees down? Well, as it turns out, the ditch cleaning work has federal funding that does the ditch cleaning work but doesn't cut down trees. So until the trees fall down in the road, they weren't going anywhere. So we kind of, you know, let this jiggle for a little while, and I do, you know, want to sincerely say I appreciate the work of Central Region that I was working with there. They're very cooperative, trying to help us figure this out. And finally, we worked it out so that DOT Central Region crew was able to come in and provide traffic control while we brought in the LRSA, and they used their saws and a truck to get the trees brought down in the road. We got it all cleaned up, and the community then came and picked up all the slash and the trees and got some firewood out of it. So it was a wonderful learning experience, and you're right, Representative McCabe, through the chair, there was a couple offers along the way of in the dark of the night, we could have just solved this problem really quickly early on. But I didn't want to, I wanted to figure out how to solve this problem, not just make the two trees go away.
Follow up.
I'm never asking you a question again.
Thank you, Mr. McCabe. I will keep track of that. There are kind questions and there are kind answers, and sometimes you want neither.
Okay. Any further questions for Representative Holland? Representative Mina.
Thank you, Co-Chair Eichheit. Through the Co-Chair, I'm looking at Section 2, specifically about the report on prioritizing these different WUI zones. I noticed that under page 2, lines 14 through 16, the list of consultation includes local municipalities, community organizations, MPOs, regional transportation planning orgs, and service areas. I don't see tribal governments, and my curiosity is, I'm not an expert on the traditional burning that a lot of different indigenous groups have done for hundreds or thousands, tens of thousands of years, but I'm wondering if you could just comment on the role that these groups and these firekeepers have as it relates to DOT now having this new responsibility on wildfire management or more structured responsibility on wildfire management.
Yeah, thank you. Through the co-chair to Representative Mina, good question. We have not been involved with the local tribal organizations or sought their input, and I think you've raised an interesting point that we should consider how that connection might be made. I wish I had a better answer at the moment.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative St. Clair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Holland, got a couple of questions here. In your sponsor statement, you mentioned wildfire a whole bunch of times, but in the bill, I only see it once, and it's to do a report about wildfires to the legislature. Can Am I missing something there?
Representative Holland.
Yeah. Through the co-chair, the implied, and perhaps maybe it needs to be more explicit in the duties found in page 3, line 6 there, developing the program in the wildland-urban interface. It's implied that the wildland-urban interface is a wildfire hazard area. Perhaps that might be a little more explicit, but generally in the vernacular of those that are working in wildfire areas, WUI is are those areas that have exposure to wildfires and have high risk of vegetation and wildfire spread. So that's the main focus there in that duty section.
Okay. And
Follow up.
Representative Holland, where can I find the definition of WUI?
Yeah, thank you. Through the co-chair, I'd want to, as we discussed with Representative McCabe earlier, defer to Division of Forestry to find out how their definition is specifically defined here in Alaska. But it's a nationwide framework for addressing the area that is sometimes discussed as either a wildland-urban interface or sometimes an intermixed zone that reflects an area that has urban development within an area of wildland potential fire vegetation.
One last follow-up.
Follow-up.
If I may.
Yes.
How many of these do we have we identified? How many areas have we identified that meet the three, I think they're the three criteria, the vegetation for wildfire, the single exit, or at least those two? Do we have a total count? I'm sorry.
Yeah. Thank you. Through the co-chair. I don't have a good number. I know we've begun, you know, looking at maps, trying to identify that. That was part of the intent behind how this bill is structured. Rather than having a prescriptive solution, we had the uncodified section saying, let's look at this. I know the Community Wildfire Protection Plan for Anchorage that we just updated this year identified this as a major issue, and most all of the I'm trying to remember the SPU's sub-planning units or something that they broke it up into. Personally, in my district, I know that there's, you know, at least 10 at this point just in my district. And I think in every one of your districts, I think I could point to a couple roads pretty quickly where you have one road going into a residential area. We did a little bit of scanning in Fairbanks. I did a little bit of scanning, you know, out in the Glen Allen and down in Richardson Highway, and kept finding, you know, time after time, individual roads that went back to significant residential areas. So it's a fairly broad area. And I think it's going to be an interesting challenge to figure out how do we prioritize this issue. The last thing I want to do is see a community burn down because we can't get in and people can't get out. But right in Anchorage, we're facing that problem right now.
I agree. Thank you.
I don't know. Aiden, did you have any more information? Had you looked at that?
Through the chair, the representative answered it better than I could have. I can think of at least 12 off the top of my head, but would be happy to provide you with those in your district if you'd like.
Not required. Thank you.
And I would just request if you could send us that definition of the wildland-urban interface, what that means, so the committee can better understand that.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I'll chat with Division of Forestry and see if they have something official. Like I said, there's a project going on that's updating the definition. So it's
gotcha. Representative Carrick. Oh, I anticipate a question. Is there any further questions from the committee for Representative Holland and staff? Okay. Well, seeing none, thank you, Representative Holland. Thank you, Mr. Aiden Nickel. Appreciate you being here presenting on this. We'll set this aside for the moment and look forward to that definition.
And Co-Chair, I know we've got, I think it's Mr. Mills here from DOT. I don't know if you want to talk at all. There's a fiscal note that was put out that I think does a pretty good job of also kind of reinforcing and outlining the scope of this work. So I don't want to miss the opportunity of potentially having you explore that if you're interested.
Representative McCabe.
Yeah, one last thing, just kind of while I'm thinking of it. Team Rubicon is a hotshot crew, if I'm not mistaken, right?
To the co-chair, Team Rubicon has a couple different functions. They do definitely do emergency disaster event response, but they also have a broad array of training programs that they offer, certification, capacity building. And so in our case, this was going to be I think they would call it a white shirt event, where they work with both the primary gray shirt folks and the Team Rubicon, but then they invite in community members to do joint projects of community service. So it has a community service element and a disaster response. They use the community service as a way to develop skills and capacity to be more ready for a disaster event.
Quick follow-up, just follow-up. A comment. So yep. A couple of years ago when I was maybe 4 years ago or 5 years ago, we did a funding bill, I think, to fund hotshot crews through the off-season months, and they would go like they're doing one on Lynx Lake Road, which is a borough road, but it's one way in, one way out, Victory Bible Camp at the end of it, and they are clearing the underbrush so that there is an escape route, and that's how they're getting their training.
Exactly.
And I'm wondering if that's maybe not something that the DOT, for some of these that they are in the off-cycle mm-hmm. for their vegetation clearing, would be considering using a hotshot crew and calling it training and letting him do that. Anyways, yeah, just a comment. You don't have to answer.
Yeah. No, you're spot on. This discussion is exactly the opportunity that we've been working on and doing.
Perfect.
And then, Mr. Mills, did you want to make any comments on the fiscal note? And they can be brief, because I would like to move to the next bill on the agenda.
Andy Mills, Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, for the record. So I guess, again, the fiscal note does outline sort of what we envision. I think I'll just make a couple points maybe from the department so that you can chew on those a bit. That on this particular legislation, again, this is a planning effort, not an execution effort. And I want to be clear that we framed the fiscal note from a putting that prioritized plan together. The intent language that was referenced before is the report I helped lead, so I have a fairly strong idea from the sponsor here what they're looking for. I would also note that it's state-only roads, and again, I believe the sponsor spoke to what localities would also do for non-state roads. I do want to mention on the functional classification piece that the sponsor did also refer to functional classifications not taking into account, and I want to be sure that I sort of maybe mention, not in defense, but just in clarification, that the functional classification has a very specific purpose. It's federally required every 10 years after a census. It doesn't take that into account because that's not what the federal requirements call for, but it can lend to information that we then leverage in this way. And I'll leave also with, in coordination with Department of Natural Resources, in conversations with the sponsor, we have continued to work on where we would take, again, you see it in the fiscal note, but to expound upon that, GIS mapping, where we can try and put data on our roadways where there is a no outlet, and overlay that perhaps with data sets from DNR, which has a very robust GIS section, so that they can take the wildfire hazard and mitigation data and try to narrow this down, again, fine-tuning it with the solicitation input that is there. So it's a lot of work. We'll certainly do our best to meet the full intent of what is there. Certainly amending DOT's powers is not maybe always. Well, I got that. Certainly some other people have some legislation that does the same thing. But intent language is what we could probably do this with. But the fiscal note articulates what bringing full staffing that don't put project code costs to that effort, and what a full solicitation through some consultant contracting that we normally do with a project. But there is no project code to put that against. So that's what you'll see in the note. And obviously I'm available if there's any other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Mills. Thank you, Representative Holland. We're going to move now to our next thing, which is House Bill 217, Autonomous Vehicles, but we're going to do a brief at ease to get ready. At ease. back on the record. In our final bill discussion today, the committee will now move to House Bill 217, Autonomous Vehicles. Questions on the bill will be taken by Representative Carrick and her staffer, Griffin Scale, on behalf of the committee. Before we begin, we have a new committee substitute before us, which was circulated to members yesterday. Members will recall from the history that two amendments were made to House Bill 217, one by Representative Mina and one by Representative Nelson. So, Representative Carrick, do we have a motion?
Mr. Co-Chair, I move that we adopt committee substitute for House Bill 217-34-LS0950/N.
And I will object for purposes of discussion. And so at this point, I'd invite Griffin Scale up to the dais to talk about changes between the CS and the original House Bill 217.
Thank you. Through the chair for the record, Griffin Sukeo, staff to the House Transportation Committee, as well as Representative Carrick's office. The summary of changes from version A to N are as follows. Section 1, subsection B, 1, the definition of commercial vehicle is added to this subsection, clarifying that this legislation does not apply to vehicles used for personal, non-commercial use, has a gross weight of 10,000 pounds or less, and is designed for transportation not more than 16 passengers, including the driver. Section 1, subsection E, clarifies that this legislation does not apply to personal delivery delivery devices, which are electrically operated on a sidewalk or path within the right-of-way of a highway intended primarily to transport property weigh less than 120 pounds, excluding cargo, has a minimum speed has a maximum speed of 10 miles per hour, and is equipped with technology to allow for operation of the device with or without the active control or monitoring of an operator who monitors or exercises direct physical control over the navigation system and operation of the device.
Thank you, Griffin. Are there any questions on the CS that's before us? Seeing none, I will remove my objection. Seeing no further objections, we have adopted the CS as our working document. Is there further discussion on this bill? And I would like to add to the committee's awareness, we have some folks online that can assist. We have Kathy Wallace, the Director of DMV, Department of Administration. We have Benjamin Glenn, Emerging Technologies Coordinator, DOT and PF. And we have Claire Radford, Legislative Counsel, Legal Services. Do we have Representative St. Clair?
I guess this would be for, thank you, Mr. Chair, for Ms. Radford. Looking at this legislation, this does not apply to privately owned vehicles, correct?
Ms. Radford?
For the record, this is Claire Radford with the Legislative Legal Services. I'm sorry, Representative St. Clair, could you please repeat your question?
Yes, ma'am. Regulation, this bill, does not apply to privately owned vehicles such as a Tesla or anything that doesn't meet the criteria as specified in B1.
Representative St. Clair, I'm sorry, I haven't specifically considered whether or not this would apply to something like a Tesla, but I do not believe that it does based on the language of the bill.
Thank you.
It's affirmation. Oh.
There are further questions? Okay. Well, seeing none.
Maybe take a brief at ease.
We're going to just take a brief at ease here. Excuse me. back on the record. We have House Bill, the CS for House Bill 217 before us. Seeing no further questions, Co-Chair Carrick, do you have a motion?
I move House Bill 217, also known as 34-LS0950/N, from committee with attached fiscal notes, and authorize legislative legal to make any technical and conforming changes.
Seeing no objections, the CS for House Bill 217 is moved from committee. That brings us to the end of our agenda today. Just a reminder to everyone, the committee, that Thursday we don't have a regular meeting, but we will have a field trip. And I don't know if Mr. Mills wants to say anything about the field trip, but we're going to have a chance to learn about some neat DOT items. Mr. Mills, do you have any details you'd like to share with the committee at this time?
For the record, Andy Mills, thank you, Co-Chair Eichheit. So I sent an email before this meeting, which is with the basic itinerary, but a major caveat that it is tentative given significant winds that are presenting a hazard right now on that avalanche to the point where I don't know if it's occurred already, but there is consideration of potential closure of Thane at this time given the increased avalanche hazard. And so there is a possibility that we will not have that field trip on Thursday as we all hoped because it is very fun to demonstrate some of our operations and you get to see it in person. But we also don't want to put ourselves in harm's way and have a group out there. So that would be the I'll provide an email tomorrow to everyone that was on the invite as to what the update is. And I have some video after we're done to show you just how bad it is up there.
Okay. And Representative Nelson has a question, I believe.
Thank you, Co-Chair Eichheit. Isn't that the point? Isn't this like the perfect opportunity?
Let's do a real one.
Yeah!
I don't think Mr. Mills wants the
Mr. Mills?
Just a question?
Any comments, Mr. Mills? Obviously. The enthusiasm on the committee is high.
Yes. Through the co-chair, thank you for your enthusiasm. I don't want to be responsible for a portion of this legislative body going missing for any portion of time. So we will examine our options, and trust me, if we can err on the side of doing so, we will try.
Okay. Thank you, Representative McCabe.
No, I'm good.
Okay. So our next House Transportation Committee meeting will be Tuesday, March 3rd at 1 o'clock p.m. And just a reminder to members to stick around to sign the paperwork on the House bill that we just moved out of committee. And with that, this meeting of the House Transportation Committee is adjourned at 2:51 p.m.